For Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney, convincing city council to enact a sugary drink tax could be just half the battle. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The next opposition could come in the form of lawsuits aimed at destroying the levy before it even starts. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports that Kenney already has a team of attorneys working on his defense strategy.
Monte wrote an internal memo to Mayor Jim Kenney saying he has a high degree of confidence that the city has the authority to enact a so-called soda tax.
If there's a lawsuit with respect to this, we'll be prepared.
Looking into his crystal ball, the city solicitor imagines two possible attacks. The first is that critics might say it's a duplicate sales tax. The state already taxes sugary drinks, so the city can't do it too. Talante has a creative answer to this.
It's not a sales tax for a couple of reasons. One, the tax here will be imposed on the distributor or the retailer, not on the consumers.
And also because it's a tax based on the amount of liquid, not the price. So technically, that's not a sales tax, according to a strict reading of Pennsylvania law.
If it quacks like a tax, it's a tax.
Larry Seisler represents the opponents of the proposal, including the American Beverage Association. He says it should be up to a court to decide the technicality, not the mayor. The it's not technically a sales tax point is not a strong argument, says Adam Finkel with Penn's Law School.
It's always going to be partially passed through to consumers, no matter where you levy it.
The second possible legal attack Talante wrote about would accuse the soda tax of being arbitrary. Pennsylvania's Constitution says a single item can't be unjustly singled out and taxed. Is it just to tax soda and other sweet drinks?
And I think the answer is fairly obvious, yes, because of all the health deficits associated with the sugary drinks.
In other words, because these drinks are associated with diabetes and obesity, the city should have legal cover. Talante says it's not at all arbitrary. Meanwhile, Seisler with the Coalition to Stop a Soda Tax says preparing for possible lawsuits makes one thing clear.
Obviously, the administration is very concerned about the legality of the tax.
He says not calling it a sales tax and saying it's a special case is a PR move.
They have to sell it to the public. And the fact is that they know from their own polling that residents of this city feel taxed out.
But the Kenney administration says, where else is Philadelphia going to find the cash to fund pre-K for all city children and support improvements to parks and libraries? Whether the plan goes forward could eventually hinge on the opinion of judges. Does it perfectly follow the state's constitution and other Commonwealth law? The Kenney team is ready to respond to two attacks, but critics say they should also be ready for a surprise. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
I want a little sugar in my bowl.
Pennsylvania's Auditor General issued a scathing report damning the state charter law today. As WHYY's Kevin McCory reports, the Auditor General blamed many of the Philadelphia School District's fiscal woes on Harrisburg lawmakers for not revising the nearly 20-year-old law.
Auditor General Eugene DePasquale says the game has been rigged against districts like Philadelphia, where charter expansion has been widespread.
Our charter school law is simply the worst charter school law in the United States.
After auditing 4 years of data on Philadelphia's charter sector, DePasquale says the law fails to give districts power to ensure that only high-performing charters that serve all children are opening and that the opposite are closing. He blamed recent failed efforts in Harrisburg to reform the law on special interest lobbying.
What else could it be?
DePasquale also targeted a few specific actions that occurred under former Governor Tom Corbett for deepening Philadelphia's woes, including ending the funding that helped cover the added costs of the charter sector.
It literally became a fight for funding, and that has to stop.
DePasquale also decried the fact that state Republicans amended the 2014 cigarette tax to make it easier for charters to open in Philadelphia. He says costs incurred by the district because of this will soon outstrip the benefits, especially because the tax revenues will expire in 3 years. Democrats had pushed for the cigarette tax and chose to continue pursuing the short-term funding boost even after that amendment was added. State Senator Vincent Hughes, who was at DePasquale's press conference, was one of them.
We were successful on the revenue side. We're not successful in amending to prevent the implementation of more our charters put in place.
Local charter proponents agree with the need for some reforms to the law, but fear DePasquale's recommendations would limit the charter's recourse to fight non-renewal. Bob Fayfitch is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Coalition for Public Charter Schools.
Persistently underperforming charter schools and public schools should be closed, but the due process is something that needs to be in place for everybody.
DePasquale will release an audit of the Philadelphia district itself later this spring. Kevin McCrory, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania has more than 1,000 separate law enforcement agencies, and until now, they each made their own rules for how witnesses identify suspects in a lineup. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that today, the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association issued recommendations to standardize the process and avoid false convictions.
Give a witness 6 or 8 pictures. Ask them which one, if any, shows the person they saw committing a crime. It sounds easy, but a lot can go wrong without any rules, says chairman of the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association, Tom Hogan, from Chester County.
I once saw a case where they included the suspect's brother in the identification panel. And not surprisingly, it was hard to tell the two of them apart.
Relying on a faulty eyewitness ID process can have dire consequences, he says.
You could end up convicting the wrong person. You could also end up failing to convict the right person.
According to Criminal Justice Watchdog Association, the Innocence Project, more than 75% of convictions later overturned by DNA evidence relied on faulty eyewitness testimony. Over the last 2 years, district attorneys across Pennsylvania talked with experts and police officers about how to standardize the process, and they came up with a list of instructions and best practices. The biggest takeaway, says Hogan, is to make sure the person showing the photos to the witness doesn't know enough about the case to influence the outcome.
That way, there's no bias, no prejudice involved by the administrator of the test.
Policy director with the Innocence Project, Rebecca Brown, says these protocols don't go quite far enough to ensure accuracy. One key component that's missing is having witnesses say just how confident they are in their selection when they pick a suspect. She says that can help officers avoid building a case around a shaky witness. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania's April 26th primary does not include judgeships on the ballot. Those elections take place in odd number years, though many consider it odd every year that voters decide who serves for 10-year terms on the Pennsylvania Supreme, Appellate, and Common Pleas Courts. Lynn Marks is Executive Director of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts. She's stepping down after 25 years of advocating for merit selection of Pennsylvania judges. Lynn Marks, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave. Appreciate it.
What was the initial impetus or calculus behind judicial elections?
Well, judicial elections started in this state around the time of Jacksonian democracy, when there was really more of a populist wave. There have been some changes in the 60s. There was a change that after a judge has been on the bench, that judge doesn't run in a contested election, but runs in what's called a retention election, which is nonpartisan.
Is it possible to analyze whether states with elections do that job better or worse than states where judges are not elected?
You know, it's hard to, you know, you can't, there's not a lot of data which shows that some judges are better in some ways, whether they're appointed or whether elected. There have been more discipline complaints against those who have been elected as opposed to appointed. Annenberg has done some surveys that have showed that people who live in states where judges are elected, like the other political branches, are more cynical about the courts. And all the polling shows that when judges are elected in partisan elections, that people overwhelmingly think that those judges will make decisions according to their campaign contributions. And I think, Dave, one of the reasons it's so important is, you know how people often say that, you know, perception's reality. And I think that's especially true when it deals with justice. You know, if people don't go to court and feel like they're getting a fair shake, regardless if they win or lose, if they don't think they're getting a fair shake, they're not going to have confidence in the court system.
What are some of the vested interests that have kept the system from evolving to date?
The organizations that have traditionally opposed moving to a merit selection process and away from elections, on the whole, have been plaintiffs' trial lawyers, some labor organizations, and the Pro-Life Federation. And those are organizations who have been very involved with the current – with the judicial election process.
Are there exit polls that solicit from voters what their calculus is in either voting yes or no for a judge on the ballot?
There's been exit polling, and this is from even the 20% of people that actually show up to vote for judge. When they've been asked who they voted for, they don't even know the names. And it's not because voters are stupid. We're not stupid. We don't know who they are, and we often don't have enough meaningful information. And so people often make their decision according to where they are on the ballot, you know, whether it's a particular ethnic name that we agree, you know, that we're part of that group, or gender, or whether they had a good advertisement. It doesn't mean that we don't have many qualified judges, but too often we're voting for people for reasons which have to do with either luck, like their ballot position, or because whether they raised enough money. And unfortunately, where that money comes from is what's the biggest beef we have with running for judge, and that is it's the lawyers and interest groups who often have cases before courts. Those are the biggest givers to judicial races. And last November, there was over $16 million raised and spent for the Supreme Court race, which is just awful. If judges were chosen with the merit selection process for our statewide appellate courts, they would widen the pool of people who would come forward to run, people who don't think they have access to either a special interest group money or other kind of money or political connections. And so you'd have a more diverse group of people putting their names in who now just aren't going to even run because they don't think they've got a shot.
Lynn Marks, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Lynn Marks is executive director of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts. She's stepping down after 25 years of advocating for merit selection of Pennsylvania judges. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Still ahead, if you think being a 76ers fan is hard, consider the plight of a ticket scalper.
Nobody wants to come and see the loser. Everybody loves the winner. You know, no one wants to come and see them play.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Giant balls of fire dangling from a crane above Delaware Avenue marked the spot for one of the most extravagant art events at this year's Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts. It's a visceral and poetic exploration of the plight of refugees around the world as presented by a Mexican theater company and a French performance collective. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez-Luna went to Penn's Landing to experience the event.
Most borderlands come alive at night. It's the time for clandestine activities, seedy commerce, and desperate acts of escape. It's when groups of people silently move towards some sort of promised land, fleeing violence, oppression, and poverty. This apocalyptic parallel universe is at the core of Article 13, the opening event of this year's Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts. Article 13 refers to a section of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights guaranteeing the right to flee your own country. In the show, every fire, sculpture, sound, and performance is sending a message of what life is like fleeing as a refugee or a migrant. Visitor Arthur Smith tries to describe all he's taking in.
It looks like we've got 20 little vignettes set up with fire, a lot of metal. There's some puppetry happening over here. Over here we've got hot pots and this gentleman with a torch.
Se divide en 10 espacios y cada espacio plantea una perspectiva muy diferente.
We function in 10 spaces, and each space represents a different perspective, says Raúl Mendoza of the Mexican theater group Teatro Línea de Sombra.
Se le invita al espectador a que pueda recorrer.
And the public is invited to go from one to another to give each person the time to explore what they see and hear. The entire event is about migration, immigration, refugees, and displacement of people. It's also about the profiteers who sell water at exorbitant prices, who sell leaky boats to African refugees and leave people stranded after they pay to cross the border.
Esto que se creó y se conceptó como un memorial y que lo sigue siendo, pues cada vez se vuelve más inabarcable, yo diría, y difícil de nombrar.
This project, which started as a sort of memorial, and still is, has changed and grown to reflect stories from around the world, says Alicia Laguna, producer and founder of Teatro de la Sombra. It's not one narrative, it's many mixed together. Laguna says she wants visitors to use their own images, emotions, and experiences to build a migration story. And some do. Aaron Hall went with his family, not expecting to be so touched by the event.
I have family, well, side family, that is from other parts of the world, Afghanistan. So I know the struggles her family had to go through to get here, and that's why I'm here now. You know,
not far from there, an immense circle of fire emerges, perhaps signifying the sun, marking the passage of time, or reminding people of its punishing presence in the hot deserts refugees traverse. And then there's the wall of people lined up against the fence as cascades of sand fall on their heads and backs. The punishing shower represents the thirst, hunger, and even torture some refugees endure. The performance landscape is peppered with videos of people telling their stories. Yes, it's risky, says a middle-aged Guatemalan man, but I'll try again and again. The north is always there, doesn't move. Nearby, piles of dirt mark the graves of those who didn't make it through. In one of the spaces, a group of men from the French group Carabas handle handmade puppets depicting trains and boats with small passengers. Why is this important to you? I asked Jean-Marie Proust, one of the puppeteers.
Parce que c'est grave, c'est un problème humain.
Because it's grave, it's serious, it's a human problem, he says. And we want to present a testimony to make people aware of this. When this quasi-pilgrimage is over, people return slowly to more familiar territory. The organizers hope they leave contemplating all they have seen with a lot of questions in their minds. Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
The Philadelphia 76ers are in Chicago tomorrow for the team's final regular season game against the Bulls. Win or lose, they'll finish with the worst record in the NBA. Dark days for the Sixers, as well as those who resell tickets to home games outside the Wells Fargo Center. WHYY's Aaron Mozell talked to one beleaguered scalper.
It's Tuesday night, one of the last home games of this miserable season.
Need tickets, guys? Need tickets?
Ronnie Gar has been selling Sixers tickets for more than four decades. He says it's never been this hard to unload seats.
Nobody wants to come and see the loser. Everybody loves a winner. You know, nobody wants to come and see them play. Plus, Okafor's out. Half of the stars are out anyway. They don't want to come. They'd rather wait for next year.
The team has barely reached double digits in the win column. Gar says even when the team is doing better, he has to compete with the internet.
StubHub's, their prices are cheap. You know, sometimes if it's sold out, those seats are expensive. But if they're not, they're just, you know, just as cheap as mine.
This season, the Sixers sold out just one home game when the Golden State Warriors, the reigning NBA champs, were in town. Overall, the Sixers have the third worst average attendance in the league. That makes Gar miss the days when Dr. J and Allen Iverson packed in fans, but he's not bitter.
It'll turn around, though. You got to take the good with the bad. Hopefully, Habib comes back next year, and we'll be all right.
The Sixers drafted the 7-foot center in 2014 with high hopes, but a stress fracture in his foot has sidelined him for two seasons. The team could have up to four first-round draft picks come June. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
The midnight train is whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry.
That's all for tonight's show. News Works Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Later this week, musicians and instrument makers will gather at the Kimmel Center to talk about what distinguishes a great instrument from a merely good one. We'll hear their string theories on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.